Today at Reader's Corner, Dan Fagan, winner of the 2014 Pulitzer Prize for nonfiction for his book, Tom's River, A Story of Science and Salvation.
It's clear that they knew that there were significant issues with both air and water pollution. But it's also true that as a society, our general knowledge of the damaging health effect has lagged far behind our ability to manufacture those chemicals. The science of epidemiology, the interpretation of patterns of illness over space and time, is really about trying to figure out whether a particular pattern has some cause. The same level of sophistication that we use in national security, we ought to use in looking at patterns of public health.
I'm Bob Kustra, president of Boise State University. Welcome to Reader's Corner. When the chemical company, SIBA, purchased a huge swath of forested land in Toms River, New Jersey, back in 1949, and laid plans to build a major factory on the site, the local citizenry mostly thought it was a good thing. But as the plant continued to generate an increasing amount of hazardous waste, there were early signs something might be amiss. Eventually, the townspeople began to connect the dots. Could there be a link between the chemical companies that used Toms River as a dumping ground and what appeared to be an elevated number of childhood cancer cases? And if so, could it ever be proved? In this acclaimed book, Toms River, A Story of Science and Salvation, Dan Fagan tells the riveting and complex story of how a small but determined number of citizens, government officials, scientists, and activists sought answers to these and other equally disturbing questions about the health impacts of environmental pollution in one New Jersey community. Toms River received the 2014 Pulitzer Prize in Nonfiction, as well as a number of other awards, including the Rachel Carson Environment Book Award and the Helen Bernstein Book Award for Excellence in Journalism. Dan Fagan teaches science journalism at New York University. He has won both of the best-known science journalism prizes in the United States, the Science Journalism Award of the American Association for the Advancement of Science and the Science in Society Award of the National Association of Science Writers. Mr. Fagan joins us by phone for this interview. Dan Fagan, welcome to Reader's Corner.
Well, thank you so much for that generous introduction.
Dan, let's begin with your teaching at NYU and your teaching science journalism. Over the course of the last few years, there's been a significant cutback in journalism positions at America's newspapers. How do you advise students interested in careers in journalism today? And do all of these new online websites and opportunities in any way make up for the loss of the old newspaper jobs?
Well, that's an excellent question, Bob, and it requires a nuanced answer, I think. Journalism is changing rapidly. I like to think of it as if our tribe is on a forced migration to a new and unfamiliar land. But it is also a land whose new topography offers really interesting opportunities. And to do our jobs well on this new landscape, we do have to change the way that we tell stories to some extent. It's true that newspapers, especially mid-sized newspapers, are in terrible shape economically. So that's a huge problem. And there are parts of journalism that, yes, I'm very concerned about the loss of the watchdog role that journalists play and the crucial independent interpretive role that journalists play. That's especially true, I think, in cities, mid-sized cities and state capitals. And it is true to some extent in terms of specialized coverage, like the kind of work that I and my students do. But at the same time, on the web, we're seeing some really fascinating new sites arise, doing wonderful experiments and trying new business models, some of which have been quite successful, delivering really great specialized coverage, including of science, medicine, and the environment, which is what my students focus on. So it's a complex picture, and it has some exciting opportunities, but also some huge challenges.
Well, reading the first few chapters of your book, it's like, did Dan Fagan go back to school in organic chemistry? Because you really give a very brilliant analysis of the challenges facing Toms River, New Jersey, through the eyes of a scientist. Is that what it means to teach science journalism at NYU?
Well, I don't have a significant amount of formal science training. I'm a journalist first, but what I am is a journalist who pays really close attention to what I read and what people tell me. And, you know, I apply the techniques of good journalism, verifying everything that you hear, trying to speak to as many people as possible, and trying to figure out what's the closest possible description to reality that I could give. So it is really helpful to have familiarity with the topic, no doubt about it. And many of my students actually have much more formal science training than I do. But even more important than specialized knowledge is a real sense of discipline about how journalists should go about doing their job. And if you do that carefully, and if you're fortunate enough to have the time and space to tell your stories well, then you can do good work.
Well, it certainly sounds from reading your book that the corporate officials at this SIBA company in Toms River certainly didn't have a very good grasp of chemistry. And to some extent, as they did have a good grasp of it, they chose simply to keep it from the public and finds all kinds of ways to get around it. Where is that line drawn? How much of this, if any, was due to the fact that these folks didn't know what they were dealing with? And how much of it is they knew exactly what they were dealing with, their corporate criminal polluters?
Well, that's also not a simple answer. I mean, it depends on which action at which moment in time. I mean, one of the things that I teach my students is that, you know, we're not mind readers. We can't say for certain what people's motivations are or what they were thinking. But if we understand the techniques of investigative reporting, we can find the documents, find the documentation that gives a sense of what people knew and when they knew it, which is a hallmark of good journalism. In the case of SIBA in Toms River, and the company at the time was called Toms River Chemical, was operated. Oh, the primary owner was SIBA, and there were two other minority owners, two other Swiss chemical firms. It's clear that they knew far before the rest of the town knew that there were significant issues with both air and water pollution. But it's also true that as a society, our general knowledge of the damaging health effects of certain kinds of molecules has lagged far behind our ability to manufacture those chemicals. So that's a problem. You know, our reach is always exceeding our grasp, and that can cause all kinds of unforeseen consequences. And Toms River, the story of Toms River is in many ways all about unforeseen consequences. Mm-hmm.
So this company, SIBA, was someplace else before it found this beautiful piece of property in Toms River. I think it was Texas, is that right, or was it somewhere else?
No, it wasn't Texas. It was actually Cincinnati, Ohio.
Cincinnati, Ohio.
And before that, it was in their home base of Basel, Switzerland. And yes, you know, that does to some extent speak to this question of what they knew and when they knew it, because, you know, as early as 1880s, this company and the other chemical manufacturers in Basel and to some extent in Germany and the UK and other places were increasingly aware of the health consequences of the products that they made. I describe in the book what happened in Basel as early as the 1860s in terms of people's water supplies being poisoned and people being hurt or even killed as a result of exposure to that pollution. As early as the 1880s, there was evidence that workers who were in these factories were suffering an unusual amount of bladder cancer. The modern chemical industry arose from the dye industry, as I explain in the book. And the dye industry, for well over a century, we've had very good information associating certain dye chemicals with very high rates of bladder cancer. So that does speak somewhat to the question of how much prior knowledge did these folks have when they transferred their practices to Toms River.
Right. So tell us about Toms River, what this property looked like, what this company was going to do with it, and how they did, in fact, dispose of their waste, and why that creates the problem that is really the reason you wrote the book.
They came to Toms River because they wanted space, and there's documentation that shows this. They wanted privacy. They wanted a place to be able to dispose of the massive amount of waste that dye production generated. It actually produces much more waste than it does dye product. Tremendous volumes of wastewater. And later, when the plant expanded to plastics manufacturing, there was a significant amount of air pollution, too, because a lot of this waste was burned. So it was really important to the Swiss owners of this particular factory that they have lots of land, that they have a water source nearby that they could discharge wastewater into, and also draw water from farther upstream, of course, because making dyes required a lot of water. I should say one other thing, too, that it's important to note there are actually two places in town that became Superfund sites and created very significant contamination problems for the people of Toms River with horrific results. And the plant that we've been talking about is one of them, but there was also an illegal dump site in the back of a chicken farm. And that dumping occurred a little later in the early 1970s. And that polluted a whole different system of water wells. So I wouldn't want to leave the impression that Sivagaigi was the sole source of the problems in town, because it certainly was not.
You're listening to Dan Fagan. He's the author of Toms River, A Story of Science and Salvation. So you have a case where this land is being polluted substantially, and people are missing it. But apparently there were some fishermen who figured it out pretty early in the game and may have been the ones that, called attention to it?
Well, they did. That was a brief episode in the early 60s. People noticed that the river was smelling, and a few people even noticed that their drinking water was smelling. And some of those people actually worked at the plant, and so they recognized that smell from the water fountains at the factories, which had been contaminated very quickly after the plant opened, within a few years. But about 10 years later, in the early 60s, the contamination began to be distributed through the public water supply system, and people began to notice it. And fishermen who fished in the Toms River also thought the water smelled, and they thought they saw an unusual amount of deformities in the fish that they caught. And that's an interesting episode because their allegations were never proven. It's very, very difficult to know for sure what the situation was before the pollution occurred. You don't know what the rate of whether it's childhood cancer or deformed fish was. And that's very relevant, I'm sure, to many of your listeners. There are certainly sites in Iowa and Montana and that general region where there are allegations of disease clusters and also a pretty significant environmental contamination. But putting those two things together can be very difficult.
So all in all, this property, a beautiful piece of property, by the way, it was pine and oak, and they managed to locate these 22 buildings in these five waste lagoons so nobody could see it. But at one point, after these fishermen got involved, the company came up with this ingenious solution to figure out another way to get rid of the waste, and that was the 10-mile solution. Help us understand what they were up to, and boy, was that a bad idea.
That's right. That was just sort of a classic avoidance kind of a response, and it has some modern analogs. You know, when we sort of outsource pollution to China, we're essentially doing the same thing. And what SIBA's idea was, why don't we build a waste pipeline, and instead of dumping this tremendous volume of wastewater into the tiny Toms River, which is more like a creek by the factory. I mean, there was a point, Bob, where there was actually as much or more wastewater in that creek as there was actual naturally occurring water. So you can imagine what that was like. So they decided to build this pipeline that went out across Barnegat Bay and then into the Atlantic Ocean. And it was a very wide pipe, and as a result, it could carry a tremendous volume of waste, so much waste that SIBA began importing. You know, they turned it into a profit center, and they took other New Jersey factories' waste and said, no problem, we'll take it, and we'll dump it in the Atlantic. There was an idea back then that the solution to pollution is dilution, that all we have to do is put this pollution in a really big place, and it can't possibly have any effect. That pipeline was a few hundred feet offshore, and it's hard to say that all that waste had a discernible effect on the Atlantic Ocean or the beaches nearby, but it certainly offended a huge amount of people. And ultimately, it became a really big rallying cry that finally, 40 years later, led to the closure of the plant. Mm-hmm.
Did any corporate officials ever pay personally, I'm thinking jail time, for any of their actions over the years?
There were criminal prosecutions and there were fines paid. I don't think anybody did actual jail time. And I have to say that that's really quite common for environmental crimes. You know, in this country, we don't treat environmental law violations as criminal violations. We treat them as problems to be solved, that you know, it's time to start negotiating because somebody's violated environmental law, violated an environmental rule. That's really a shame because what it means is that environmental violations are treated by some companies anyway as just a cost of doing business. And they'll just do a basic calculation, you know, is the fine worth it for the economic benefit that I get by doing a shortcut here and how I produce something or how I get rid of something. So that's a critical problem, and it's still a problem in this country.
Tell us about Michael and Linda Gillick. Linda is his mother, and the critical role they play in bringing this to a head.
Yes. Linda Gillick is an absolutely fascinating character, and Michael is one of her two sons. Michael was diagnosed with neuroblastoma when he was just a few months old. And back then, neuroblastoma, a cancer of the central nervous system, was a really horrific diagnosis. You know, the doctors told Linda that Michael had less than a 50-50 chance of reaching his first birthday. And you can just imagine what it felt like to hear that. Amazingly, Michael is still alive today. He's undergone many surgeries, all sorts of chemotherapy. His mom, Linda, became a cancer activist. Toms River was not, at that time, was not a large enough community to have its own pediatric cancer treatment center. So Linda and her husband, Rusty, would take Michael to either the Children's Hospital of Philadelphia or to New York Hospital in New York City to get this advanced treatment. And it seemed to Linda that whenever she went to these pediatric cancer wards, she would meet another family from Toms River. And she found that really startling. And she thought that there was a pattern, and she started keeping track. She created a map. Linda Gillick was one of those women that thought something was going on, and she started keeping track. And the experts told her, no, Linda, this is just a coincidence. Things cluster for random reasons, which is true. The whole science of epidemiology, the interpretation of patterns of illness over space and time, is really about trying to figure out whether a particular pattern is random or whether it has some cause, and then, of course, trying to identify that cause. Mm-hmm. That's exactly what happened in Toms River, thanks in part to the activism of Linda Gillick and many others. But it took a long time, far too long, and in my opinion, many children, many families in Toms River suffered needlessly because it took so long for public officials to really bring the power of science to bear on what was really happening in Toms River.
Well, the company is gone from Toms River. What does Toms River look like today? I mean, the town and the river. What do they look like today?
Well, Toms River is a good place to live. Its air and its water are relatively clean, certainly as clean or cleaner than in most suburban communities in the Northeast or other relatively densely populated parts of the country. And I would hate for people to read this book and sort of come away from it thinking, oh my God, I don't want to live in Toms River, because that's not the case at all, in part because there's been so much attention paid to Toms River. I think that its water and air are actually cleaner than in many comparable places. And the second thing that I wouldn't want people to conclude is to somehow feel sorry for Toms River and to feel like this issue is somehow unique to this town, because it is not. I wrote this book not because I think Toms River is a weird, horrible exception, but because it happens to be a place where the science was done and the activism was there to figure out answers. And in many other places, at least, The science is not being done. And what I call the secret history of Toms River, the secret history of all these other communities, is remaining secret. And that's a shame, because this is an opportunity for public health intervention that we are not taking in this country. You know, in Toms River, I show this in the book, childhood leukemia actually declined and continued to decline after the closure of the plant and the cleaning up of the two different well fields. That's a wonderful example of public health in action. We don't know for sure. Epidemiology can never tell us for sure whether a particular environmental exposure caused a particular disease. Epidemiology is by definition, it's a science of probability. But we can use probability to make common sense decisions and to say, listen, we need to be proactive here. We need to be protective. We need to take the sensible step here to reduce exposure, even if we can't say for sure that this is causing a particular health problem. And we need much more of that, not just in this country, but especially in places like China or India or Indonesia, where the chemical industry has moved in the same sense that it moved from Basel, Switzerland, to Cincinnati and then to Toms River. The chemical industry is now almost completely situated in the Far East, and it's quite obvious that many of the same problems are resurfacing. In fact, there are individual Chinese who are doing what Linda Gillick did. They're creating maps, and they're doing it quite bravely because it's a totalitarian society without a free press, of course. But this is what people do, and it's wonderful that they are doing it. But wouldn't it be great if we could somehow avoid repeating our same mistakes over and over?
Today we're talking about the Pulitzer Prize-winning book for nonfiction for 2014, Toms River, A Story of Science and Salvation by Dan Fagan. Well, you do write at the end, Dan, that one of the chief legacies of Toms River has been to solidify governmental opposition to conducting any more similar style investigations. How do you explain that? And part of it, I'm sure, is the difficulty of dealing with this cancer cluster issue, but what more is involved?
That's exactly what's going on. You know, when I wrote that, I didn't mean to say that I approve of that opposition.
Well, I understand
I certainly
that.
Don't.
Sure. Right.
I think we need to do many more cluster studies, and I think there's a lot to be learned from cluster studies if they're well done with good science. And I explain that in some detail in the book. The reason that governments are reluctant to do that, well, they're very expensive. They get people upset. They upset special interests who have a lot of political clout with governors and state legislatures and even presidents and congresspeople. And the results are often uncertain, and that makes people nervous. So they're always uncertain. By definition, there will always be some uncertainty in an epidemiological study. So for all those reasons, governments really don't like doing cluster studies. And I think that's a terrible shame, because there's a lot that we can learn by studying patterns of illness if we do it in a sophisticated way. But I'm saying that we ought to use the same level of sophistication that we use in national security. We ought to use in looking at patterns of public health, looking at where people are sick and why, and also looking at environmental exposures that may to some extent correlate with those patterns of illness. We can learn from that. The whole history of public health, as I explain in this book, is about farsighted people connecting the dots, putting things together, and ultimately being shown to be correct. We need to be doing that, much more of that in this country.
You've mentioned a couple of them, but is there any way to estimate how many Toms Rivers are out there in America, I mean?
There really isn't. Yeah, there really isn't. You know, you don't know about what you don't know about. As I explain in the book, there are a few possibilities, right? It could be that pollution was so egregious in Toms River that it couldn't possibly be repeated anywhere else. I happen to know for a fact that that's not the case. I've been an environmental reporter for 25-plus years, and I've seen plenty of places that have had analogous pollution to what occurred in Toms River. And it's very much occurring overseas in places like South Central China. You know, the other two possibilities is that, yes, there are other places like Toms River where there's a lot of pollution, but that there isn't a route of exposure to generate the kind of health outcomes. That, yeah, there's bad pollution, but in how many places is it actually contaminating the public water supply or the air that people breathe? Again, I know for a fact that that's not the case, but there's no map somewhere that we can consult that says, yes, here are the places where there's a proven route of exposure. But if you went to the EPA.gov and you looked in the Superfund list of Superfund sites, for example, you would see lots of places where there's a proven, demonstrated route of exposure by which the population in a particular place is exposed to hazardous levels of particular chemicals. So that leaves a third possibility, and that is that there are lots of Toms Rivers out there, and we simply don't know about them because nobody knows that there is a cluster. It's very hard sometimes to know if there's an unusual amount of disease. These studies often begin in very casual, informal, unscientific ways by somebody saying, gee, there seems to be a lot of cancer on my block. The bottom line is, Bob, that we don't know how many Toms Rivers are out there, but I suspect there are many.
Well, what makes the reader's blood boil on this one is the egregious offenses over the years, how long it went on, the delay in the denial of justice, and for me, the failure to get at these corporate polluters and make them pay in some way. But in the end, the good side of it, there was a settlement. We have time for this one more answer. If you could help us with what that settlement looked like and who did it take care of?
There were, I think, 69 families that were part of the legal settlement. It was a product of a long negotiation, all occurring out of court. And ultimately, the families got differing amounts, as little as $100,000 or as much as about $600,000 per family, depending on which kind of illness their child had, whether that child survived, what kind of medical care they would need for the rest of their lives, and what the evidence was that the particular kind of disease, type of cancer that that child had, was likely to have been caused by the particular pollutants that were dumped at those two Superfund sites and distributed throughout the town via the air and the water system. So I understand why the families agreed to the settlement, but I think that ultimately no one was particularly satisfied, which is really why I wrote this book, to sum up. And it's why I was so excited about winning the Pulitzer, because I want people to know that this is not a happy process and that we ought to figure out a better way of doing public health. We ought to be protective instead of being like the fire marshal that just goes to the house after it's burned down and tries to figure out what happened. We ought to be more like a fire inspector who tries to prevent tragedies before they occur. And that's why I was so happy about the attention that the book has been getting lately, because this is a very human story. There's science in the book, but it's really about real people who have gone through a horrendous tragedy and could have sort of retreated into their own private grief, but instead they chose to go public. They chose to push a broader agenda in hopes that other people would not have to go through what they went through. So I'm hoping that this book can be part of that process, publicizing what really happened in Toms River so we don't have even more Toms River.
Mm-hmm. Dan, thank you again for joining us today at Reader's Corner, and congratulations on the Pulitzer Prize.
Oh, it was a pleasure.
Again, the name of the book is Toms River, A Story of Science and Salvation by Dan Fagan. Next week, Bryce Andrews, author of Bad Luck Way, A Year on the Ragged Edge of the West. The engineer for today's show is Eric Jones. Research and production by Janelle Brown. I'm Bob Kustra. Please join me next week as we talk to today's leading writers about the ideas and issues that help shape our world at Reader's Corner.